Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and your total health environment. Your health, the health of your psyche, the health of your communities, our society, and the health of planet Earth. We begin to think about health in terms of our personal selves, and that's how we kind of monitor and maintain health. But more and more in the times we're living in, our attention is being drawn to how we need to really extend beyond the personal into the community, the social, and the total environmental, and beyond, going beyond paying lip service to interconnection, merely and only on a spiritual level, really look at the processes, the structures, the ways that we can support the health on all those levels, because they all interact for all of us and within each one of us. So that's what we discuss every week with different leaders and experts and brilliant writers and healers who come on to the show. And today we have a wonderful guest that I've been looking forward to welcoming to the show for quite some time. It's going to be a really terrific program today. My guest is Fred Irwin, Dr. Fred Irwin. He is a clinical psychologist and a pastoral counselor for over 30 years, and he works out in California, although a native of Ohio. So, you know, he's part of the whole, I have a lot of West Coast guests on this East Coast-based program, and so value their perspective and so very much value Fred's perspective. I'll confess and confide that he and I are Facebook friends. That's how we've gotten to know each other. And he is also the author of a recent PhD dissertation, which I've read, which is utterly fabulous. And we're going to be talking about it because it's so relevant. In fact, it's central to the themes that we explore every week on this program. And that is to understand not just and along with our personal history, our personal psychology, the way we were shaped by family, by traumas, by events, and by things, innate things in our own temperament and disposition and in our lives, but also understand the impact of larger social settings and how it works, the things that are going on in our society work their way into our psyche and present as symptoms that we might not immediately recognize as being due to societal impact upon us. And so that's what we're going to be talking about on today's show with Dr. Fred Irwin. Welcome, Fred. Are you there? Can you hear me?
I am here.
Great. So nice to have you here on the show.
Good to be here.
So, you know, one of the things that I see you as doing in all the writing you do is building a kind of bridge between the inner experience that each one of us has and how we connect with and validate that and the outer experience that we encounter and how we respond to that. And every week on this show, you know, I talk with environmental experts, I talk with activists, we speak with different people that are bringing some, you know, into our awareness more and more some of the conditions and dangers that we're facing in our world nowadays. But the piece that often gets left out, which is the piece that you really talk about, is how those changes in our world, both the threats that may be coming and the things that have actually happened, affect people, affect each one of us. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about how you see that?
Sure. You know, one view of the history of psychology, and not the only by any means, but one that I hold, is that psychology has slowly made its way from locating what's wrong when there is something wrong in the human psyche in the interior life of the person himself or herself through a time when we began to understand that families could have a huge impact on how people develop and how certain inner patterns develop that affect how people live in the world, how they respond to others, and often very unhealthy patterns of relationships that are replicating old family material. What I'm terribly interested in is widening that circle. so that we begin to understand not simply how the family impacts and sometimes creates symptoms, not always by any means. I mean, one of the legacies of family is often a loving growing up and an amazing human being that doesn't have lots of symptoms over the course of a lifetime. Mm-hmm. I've met a few of those. But also understanding how the village and the surrounding villages and their interactions, and then, of course, in our context, the nation state and the way we are acting upon and acted upon by events and movements and ideologies that are current in our consciousness as participants in our society. Mm-hmm. And particularly, you know, the U.S. has lived on a war footing for so many decades that we've almost forgotten that's how we live. Mm-hmm. And I've been interested since my early days as a pastor and exploring liberation theology and such constructs from Latin America and other places in how the war footing, how the nation and its protection of itself affects people's growing up, their psychic development, and their susceptibility to trauma.
So, for example, we are, you know, are taught to think or tend to think that, for example, the war may be going on, you know, our country may be at war here or there, but it's kind of, you know, that's happening over there, and, you know, and there's a kind of separation, and unless I am, you know, I have a family member who's in the military, or, you know, a veteran has been in the military, there will be a tendency to think, well, that's going on separate from me. I'm leading my life, and I have nothing to do with that. So are you saying that in a subtle way, everyone is connected when, you know, the focus of the society goes in that direction? And then more specifically, people who might experience direct impacts from the war activity, either because they're in the military, let's, as for an example, or in other ways that maybe we're not so tuned into, like which of, you know, I've kind of delineated three different kind of scopes for talking about that, or, you know, which ones, you know, are they all true, or which ones are the ones that you like to focus on? You know, it's true for everyone in the society, like, in other words, we're all affected if that's the purpose of the society, and it's true, you know, more directly, for those who are involved in war activity. You know, in fact, from the, you know, last decade or more of wars, we do have a whole new group of veterans, you know, returning from to this country with, you know, injuries, physical and mental. You know, we have, you know, different degrees, a sort of change in orientation to life when one has had certain war experiences, and you know, that in and of itself is traumatic. So that's kind of the most sort of maybe acute crisis level of people who are affected. But then we also, I guess, would have others who are affected, like, you know, family members. And then in some way, I guess, all of us would be affected. So I guess we're going to try to figure out, you know, how we talk about those different things so mm-hmm. that wherever we stand, we can you know, kind of identify with this theme. You know, so it's like kind of the acutely affected, the indirectly, you know, through relatives affected, and then the overall society as a whole that may be affected even though we're not aware of it.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. I think that it is partly very easy for society and for the communities to focus on the very acutely affected,
mm-hmm.
and certainly rightly so. Mm-hmm. We want to somehow change how we welcome veterans home, how we help them process their experiences as part of the community we are part of.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also a way, partly, of denying and discounting the degree to which society as a whole and its members individually mm-hmm. can be affected by such things as war trauma but also by such things as environmental trauma. My concern and research interest lies in particularly communal trauma,
mm-hmm.
like the poisoning of a well that affects the entire community. What does that do to the psyche? The effects of a war, not simply on its soldiers, but on those who send the soldier off to war mm-hmm. and live with the daily reports of what is happening, and the occasional trauma on the home front related to those problems.
Mm-hmm. So what would be some, I'd love to hear some examples of, you know, how communities are affected. You know, what would be symptoms of a community experiencing impact? Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think you're right. We're used to just thinking of, you know, the individual who, you know, what are some examples that you could offer so, you know, our listeners can kind of identify with what we're talking about here?
Certainly. Once upon a time, I was a very young man, and this was during the days of the Vietnam War. My brother was in the Navy at the time
mm-hmm.
and stationed in Vietnam much of that time. And several of the young men in the village I was raised in rural Ohio, had been drafted and gone to the war.
Mm-hmm.
And I must have been about 11 when we received news that one of the boys who lived down the street, who was in the Army at the time, had been killed at war.
Mm.
And his casket returned home, and the entire community, you know, this is a village of 1,700 souls. There are more people in most California graduating classes than there were in our entire school system in this little town. And so everyone knew everyone, and everyone knew that this family had lost someone.
Mm-hmm.
And there came to be this ghostly effect of the missing soldier, and rumors circulated that the body that came was not his.
Oh, my.
And all of the, that just sort of stirred the trauma and kept it semi-alive, and the community's understanding of itself and of its ethical bonds together began to shift. In terms of how do we care for one another, we don't know how, so we begin to leave one another alone and isolate,
mm-hmm.
and isolate in particular those suffering most directly, the family in this
mm-hmm.
case of the young man who'd been killed. And it began to shift, particularly in our little neighborhood. I was aware, even as a very young man,
mm-hmm.
that the community as a whole was processing this. Or failing to process it in a variety of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably the most vivid example I can give
mm-hmm.
of the ways communities are affected.
Mm-hmm.
We see similar kinds of things on a broader scale, of course, in mine disasters,
mm-hmm.
because those communities are affected, and virtually everyone who lives in the community works in the mine.
Right.
And when there is a problem and someone dies, or some several die, then the community take in all the processes of grief, sadness, tragedy, anger, denial, bargaining. All of the classic cycle of grief stuff comes up.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on where you are in the mine structure,
mm-hmm.
management, middle management, deep coal worker, and so on, the town begins to experience divisions and splits.
Mm-hmm.
And the ability of the community to care for itself is undermined because of loyalties. There are multiple levels of loyalties often in conflict with one another.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain that? I think that's a very important thing for people to understand, you know, what you're driving at there, because when you talk about, you know, when you talk about splits, you know, with different people taking different roles, it
mm-hmm.
means that, in a sense, when you look at the bigger whole, it's natural for people to take, you know, different roles. You know, in a family, someone's closer to mom, someone else maybe closer to dad.
Sure.
You know, and so all the roles that we occupy take on a function, but when those roles kind of harden, then one person is maybe, you know, carrying righteousness and another person is carrying grief, you know, instead of sort of sharing it.
Exactly.
And then that can be, that can separate people and create conflict at a time when softening and unifying is needed. You know, can you talk a little bit, you know, more about your understanding of that?
Sure. I think there are several levels at work at which that works. There is, of course, the level you just described of I'm closer to someone who got lost, and so I'm in the camp that's grieving and angry and upset. My brother has been elevated, and I'm speaking hypothetically here. Neither I nor my brother are working in any such industries.
Mm-hmm.
But a relative works on the management side, and he's concerned about his job because the mine's going to get investigated and things happen, and someone's head may roll from the management side because something wasn't done or was done wrongly.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're deeply bought into that corner of the concern, and the two of us then are not mutually available to one another at a time when both of us are going through some kind of panic.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, as in families, when things happen and families divide up loyalties in small units, the family suffers just as the community suffers in the larger picture, by not being available to one another at a time precisely when we're processing all of the factors of grief and tragedy and trauma,
mm-hmm.
when precisely we need to be, and when studies show in the immediate aftermath that if communities, if families can care for one another well in those, if you will, some of the studies are on separation anxiety,
mm-hmm.
in those immediate post-separation problems, if we can care for one another well, we often mitigate the ongoing and later expression of trauma and other problems. And so that division of loyalty within the community into several stripes impairs our ability to really work with one another and consequently to be with one another as a healing presence. And by no means do you have to be a psychologist, a doctor, or anything else to be a healing presence. The only real requirement there is that we be available to one another.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it is often the case that the less said, the better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a pastor, I found that when people are in trauma, what they need of me most is simply to go there and shut up,
mm-hmm.
simply to be with them. Offer no words of advice, comfort such as one can, but even there, just let yourself be with them in such a way that they will eventually be comfortable to teach you what they need, because they will know. And that's a hard thing, but it's not something that only the professionally trained can do. But when communities are divided in that way, not even the professionally trained can be available to one another. And I think that there's also a much deeper split that happens in times like this. My own belief is that there's an inner knowing in the human being, and I, you know, my prejudice would be that this is true in all cultures, in all places. That is an unexperimentally validated
mm-hmm.
prejudice, but
mm-hmm.
that there's a knowing when things are right and when things are wrong, when we need to be together and when we can't afford not to be together. And when that is disturbed, it disturbs the layer, the inner layer of value. It crushes the, you know, this is my value, this is how we ought to be. And when for some reason, because of other external loyalties, we can't be that way,
mm-hmm.
then the other layer of loyalty that gets violated is our loyalty to our values.
Mm-hmm.
And that creates a huge inner trauma. That creates the thing that we so often see in vets, that they were raised to believe that the world was to be a good place, that we were not supposed to kill, that we were this, we were that. And suddenly they're placed in a situation where they must act often to preserve their own lives and the lives of their comrades and buddies, which military training places at a premium.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process, they violate their own deepest and in some sense oldest values, values from childhood, as it were,
mm-hmm.
that they were taught. And it is that fracture of the inner world, that fracture of my loyalty to who I believe myself to be as a person, as a spiritual person, as a civil person in Western liberal society,
mm-hmm.
Western enlightenment values and all that sort of thing. And when that gets fractured, then it further complicates the relational fracture and it sets off a grief process that is almost subterranean in nature. And in my experience, this goes on in the general population all the time unrecognized.
So, for example, you know, in talking about the general population, you know, if, let's say, I hold the belief that, you know, I want to leave things better than I found them, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that was a value inculcated in me by my family growing up, and that's something I like to feel about myself.
Mm-hmm.
But then I am, you know, put savings in the stock market, and, you know, there's some mutual funds, and they are containing, you know, various kinds of companies that do things that are actually despoiling the earth. I mean, this is something that Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein are now raising awareness about through the Do the Math campaign and the campaign to divest from fossil fuel industry investments on the part of academia, you know, colleges and universities, where young people who are very concerned about the future
mm-hmm.
of our planet are, you know, studying and training mm-hmm. for their, you know, participation and giving into our society in their adult lives.
Right.
So, you know, as, you know, an organization or individuals or, you know, businesses or other kinds of companies that have pension plans that may be, you know,
mm-hmm.
kind of tied in, we
mm-hmm.
kind of right away with that, that's one example of a disconnect that we all kind of, oh, well, that's something else and this is what we have to do and it's impossible to get out of it. But are you saying, so even though we may, you know, house and aspire to certain values and, you know, try to enact them in a personal way close to home, are you saying that that kind of indirect engagement with things that maybe actually violate that value is something that people actually on some subtle level feel?
I think particularly to the degree that people begin to be consciousness,
mm-hmm.
Be conscious of
mm-hmm.
it. Certainly we can, as humans, we are very skilled at maintaining just really amazing levels of denial.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as what I don't know won't hurt me is, you know,
mm-hmm.
one of the common phrases of our culture.
Mm-hmm.
Or what they don't know won't hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a level of rigidity that we sometimes maintain in order to not know.
Mm-hmm.
To the degree that someone begins to be aware that things are being done on their behalf that violate their values,
mm-hmm.
to the degree that they can change that and in the process feel empowered, they really are in an excellent position to not be deeply affected in the long term by it. To the degree that they're stuck in a place that they have no power to change that,
mm-hmm.
then yes, I believe it does begin, and certainly my experience as a researcher has been that it does begin to affect the psyche in a way that leads to effectively traumatic symptoms. The sense that something is being violated here and I cannot control it and I cannot change it. And because of that, I too am being violated.
So in that what you're describing there, people are at the one moment victims and perfectrators. So
exactly.
The sense that, you know, I cannot control it, I'm being harmed by it and maybe feeling grief on a subtle level that I'm not aware of.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, by partaking in activities, investments, working at jobs that, you know, kind of do in various ways do harm,
mm-hmm.
One is also functioning or enabling or, you know, kind of running with the forces that are perpetrating in the society. So that what you're describing is actually very confusing because people, all of us in some degree perhaps, function as a combination of, you know, perpetrators and victims. We have both things going on simultaneously.
Well, and that's one of the peculiar dynamics of the most serious cases of trauma we see,
mm-hmm.
that there's the inner violation of value,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that we somehow participated in that.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the whole process of projection and inner confusion that arises when we find ourselves in a situation where we are violating our own values,
mm-hmm.
or finding those violated, is part of what complicates that. There's this inner problem of not being able to fully separate, for most people,
mm-hmm.
themselves well enough to see in themselves the place where they carry the same energy of the violator,
mm-hmm.
if you will.
Sure.
It's a difficult challenge to let ourselves see that we carry in ourselves the inner postal worker,
mm-hmm.
or such things, that we're in a place where when things go wrong, we are capable of the same kind of anger and rage that we've been hurt by,
mm-hmm.
or that we are capable of being as sneaky. Or as, what's the right phrase here? As compromised,
mm-hmm.
by the choices we make,
mm-hmm.
as anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know whether I'm getting to that point very well or not, Alison.
No, I think it's really it's an important point, and it's not the this is a more in-depth level. Of looking at what really is going on with us that
mm-hmm.
is beyond some of the pat prescriptions which, you know, at one time I think raised consciousness, but which now have been, you know, incorporated by many people to the point that constantly repeating them becomes a form of stagnation in our psychological growth, in my humble opinion.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I feel that what you're articulating really represents the next frontier, and as such, you know, it may be a little unaccustomed, but I think that in listening carefully to what you're saying, that, you know, if we allow it to kind of penetrate and we allow ourselves to identify with it and feel that we can safely do so, I think it's taking us to a new, you know, place. We are going to have to break right now for station identification before we proceed with the second half of the show, and so
okay.
I want to ask our listeners to stay with us on Connect the Dots for the second half of the show. I'm Alison Rose Levy, and I'm talking today with Dr. Fred Irwin about how society impacts our psyche. Welcome back, listeners. This is the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Alison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern on the Progressive Radio Network. And in today's show, we're talking about the impact of societal forces on the psyche of each one of us and how we really There's a lot more going on there in terms of living in difficult times and how we experience that and cope with it. And we're talking with Dr. Fred Irwin, a psychologist and pastoral counselor. If you're interested in this conversation and want more like these, you can sign up for my Facebook page, Connecting the Dots for Health. I do show announcements every week, as well as a lot of links for activism, interesting articles, commentary, and insight. We're looking for Fred Irwin to put forth his own website one day and offer some of his brilliant insights, as we're doing today on the show, and I will announce that whenever it's happening. Going back to, we were kind of delving into how some things that are just kind of business as usual, the very things that we sort of write off and say, oh, well, I can't do anything about that. That's just the way it is, and I'm kind of participating. But you're pointing out on some level it doesn't sit well. We don't feel good about it, even when we try to deny it or rationalize it or say, well, I may be doing this bad thing over here, working for this company that, is kind of doing, selling products that, let's say, harm children in some way. Mm-hmm. Some people say it doesn't harm children, so maybe it's okay. And meanwhile, I'm kind of active in my community, or I do stuff for friends and family members, and so it all kind of balances out. So we compartmentalize. We kind of go, well, I'm doing this over here, so this over here isn't quite so bad. But you're saying that the more aware we are, the more those kinds of compartmentalizations, splits, the ways that we all kind of get roped into participating in some of the more nefarious things that go on in our society, on some level we feel the uneasiness of that.
Yeah, and I think that's a great description of the, as you say, the inner compartmentalization that goes on, that really creates, often subconsciously, a split between the values we espouse and what we're actually doing. And we can manage those. We are humans. We're good at splitting and ignoring the splitting and just sort of going on about our business. But then something impinges from the outside. A natural disaster. An episode of mass violence. A major technological problem. A problem at a nuclear plant, for example. And we've seen episodes of these in the last couple of years on grand scales, from Fukushima to Sandy Hook to Hurricane Sandy as it hit New York and the East Coast. And suddenly, people, often people we know, often ourselves, are suddenly affected at a major level by an external stressor. And all these little internal stressors and cracks that we've been carrying split wide open.
It's like keeping it together with all of these different cracks and compartmentalizations becomes too hard.
Right.
When there's this external additional stress.
Exactly. We become less able to hold the tensions of that compartmentalization. And so that we find ourselves suddenly aware that we work for an oil company, and we've been sort of aware that that's a problem and that there are things that get in the way of that, or that we're heavily invested, and suddenly we're aware that global warming is a problem and this hurricane just hit my neighborhood, and how we're met. How we meet one another in the midst of those natural disasters, those community traumas, if you will, is critical in how we manage the new awareness of the inner splits that come forward as a part of those, and consequently in how we cope with the greater traumas, which turn out in the long run to be both an inner process and an outer event.
So So here we're kind of seamlessly going back and forth,
mm-hmm.
in terms of discussing different ways that this interaction happens, because, and I just feel the need to note this, but in terms of the realm of psychology and spirituality, at a certain place, some of the teachers or masters or experts who evolved the field, the pioneers who evolved these different fields from, you know, the beginning or from our first encounters with them, mm-hmm. kind of drew a line where they basically said, this is the line of myself. Within myself, it's my job to manage my responses to whatever goes on out there,
right.
and not to change or interact with what goes on there. And ideally, if I were managing my, if I had a perfect childhood and no prior trauma and, right livelihood and perfect psychological immunity, as you describe it, one would be able to take a whole series of negative inputs from the outer world and respond seamlessly. Of course, this I always regard as hypothetical, because many of the people modeling this are very successful people who perhaps have never faced the kinds of adversities of health or economic crisis or other things that on my health beat I see people going through all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's never tested, but it is asserted and often repeated, all I can do is deal with my response, and whatever's happening out there, the ideal would be if I had a perfectly neutral response to it, or could greet it with love and happiness. Does that place an additional burden on people to believe that that's how high the bar must be set in a time when, as you're describing, we're having natural disasters due to climate change, economic problems, socio-political threats of various kinds? I mean, are we setting a realistic bar for people in terms of their personal self-development?
Hmm.
Is that an attainable thing? Is that what we should be seeking?
I think maybe what we're seeking is a way to train ourselves as individuals and community,
mm-hmm.
to be present with one another regardless of what happens.
Mm-hmm.
To find ways of maintaining our own center in the midst of a crisis,
mm-hmm.
so that we can be with one another. Now, that's harder for some people than others, there is no doubt, and I don't want to by any means pathologize folk whose skills for meeting that are not perhaps as strong as those skills that others might have.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's unreasonable to expect that at least a considerable portion of the population can remember that in the midst of suffering, we move out to assist those who are in more pain than ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly we saw that on the East Coast with
mm-hmm.
Sandy and Occupy Sandy coming in.
Right.
And the effects that had on the local populations in terms of being able to find their own inner resources to meet what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, by all report, I have not been there, but by all report, that created a much more effective engagement than did some of what the government engagements.
Yes, we've had, and I urge listeners to the show to go into the Connect the Dot archives, because we did several programs, both about the environmental lessons from Occupy Sandy, as well as reports from people on the ground working there, who describe exactly, what you share there, Fred,
mm-hmm.
and please, listeners, look up those shows as well. You're saying that it's always helpful to become a resource, both for yourself and for others, to the extent of your ability to do that. That can never be a bad thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be all we need to do in terms of building a more humane, value-based society. That's a whole other kind of task that we might have as well, so that we're not, you know, we lessen the extent of trauma that's being visited upon
right.
ourselves and others.
But then there's also the follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have found, what we've learned,
mm-hmm.
is that when communities can come together in the aftermath of a tragedy
mm-hmm.
and process together what worked well and what went wrong,
mm-hmm.
where they were met and where they were not,
mm-hmm.
and move through the process of gathering together resources. One of the things we've learned, for example, is that there are often not the resources in place that we would like,
mm-hmm.
that people get left out of the resources that are there,
mm-hmm.
that some people are just up in front excluded
mm-hmm.
from resources in various ways, in various tragedies.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that the community can gather and begin to pull together an accurate narrative of what really happened, because sometimes the trauma is deepened by after effects of people, government agencies, and the like,
mm-hmm.
asserting that they were there and they did a fine job and everything was great. So you begin to get this community narrative that everything's okay, that everything's under control, that everything's fine.
Hmm.
But members of the community know better.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that they can gather and begin to reconstruct the authentic narrative
mm-hmm.
of what happened to them, that begins to activate a certain agency in the individual, a willingness to step forward and say, just a darn minute, this did not work well for me. And I need you, one another, to assist me in moving forward with this, and you need me. And once one person begins to do that in a mm-hmm. community setting, others will speak up and others will begin to say, well, that was not my experience, but this was my experience.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that the community can do that reconstruction in an effective way,
mm-hmm.
it begins to mobilize inner resources that individuals may not know that they had.
Mm-hmm.
because they hadn't had a place and a space to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
It also begins to mobilize community resources that they may not have known was there. My plumbing is out. I can't do anything. I can live with so-and-so across town for the next several days while things come back online.
Mm-hmm.
It also begins to mobilize, if you will, the psycho-spiritual resources in that you begin to see communities make ritual, make ceremony that acknowledges what has happened
mm-hmm.
and sets in some sense a communal intention for the future, either that such a thing not happen again
mm-hmm.
or that we be prepared differently to meet one another in the context of what happens next.
Mm-hmm.
That mobilization of inner and community resources is huge to the process of meeting the interior wound of trauma. So in a sense, we're in this process addressing both the communal trauma. This happened, we lost this many buildings, we lost this many churches, we lost this many children. We also begin to address, and in some sense, in some small way, begin to soothe the anxiety and the panic and the betrayals of inner loyalties and layers of connection that the individual carries, often completely quietly and invisibly to her neighbors or his colleagues.
And that's where people, as you described earlier in the program, sort of shut down, isolate, leave a dialogue, don't avail themselves of connecting with others because, you know, there are these kinds of different ways that we carry hurt feelings, and then when there isn't a feeling that, you know, we have a way to share and express them and to be heard, mm-hmm. Then it will cause that kind of shutdown, and then everyone is kind of isolated and sort of feels more alone and burdened, and we're not accessing the resource of community
right.
at the time we most need it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And part of the challenge is, in my view, and certainly part of the object of my research, was to understand how this happens in a low-grade level all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to visit the great traumas necessarily
mm-hmm.
to see the ongoing low-grade effects of people's values being ignored,
mm-hmm.
people not being included in the dominant narrative, or people buying into the dominant narrative and having their experiences really betrayed by it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We see this in ethnic minority communities who buy into the great American dream, and then due to the structural effects of racism mm-hmm. and classism in our culture, don't ever get to quite participate in it in the way that they see others participating in it. And more in the socioeconomic setting we see ourselves in with this new great economic problem, mm-hmm. we're still calling it the Great Recession, which intrigues me somewhat, we find that more and more people are expressing in various ways the anxiety, the problem of having been sucked into, having bought into the deep American dream, the property ownership, the I want this, I want that, the consumerist society, and in the process finding themselves excluded by it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are a couple of ways that can go. To the extent that the community can gather and say, wow, we bought into this narrative and it didn't work out for us.
Mm.
And what are we going to do about that?
Mm.
How are we going to work with that?
Mm-hmm.
Is the narrative really a valid one to begin with?
Mm-hmm.
And if not, how do we change it?
Mm-hmm.
And in that process, again, you begin to mobilize inner resources. You know, I suddenly realized that isn't really what I value. I don't need a house with a 5-car garage and a gardener and a maid and 3 cars. I need a place to raise my children safely and a place where I can love them deeply. And so values get revisited, strengthened. People in communities find ways that they are more alike than they knew,
mm-hmm.
form new alliances,
mm-hmm.
build new bridges, and all of that really is about changing the level of agency people are exerting in their own lives,
mm-hmm.
which is a hugely healing part of trauma recovery,
mm-hmm.
is for the person who's experienced trauma at any number of levels to discover that they can still act
mm-hmm.
on their own behalf
mm-hmm.
and eventually on behalf of another. But because this low-grade material is there all the time, there is what I call a certain level of background trauma, if you will,
mm-hmm.
in the population at large that leads us to a certain greater susceptibility when the big events hit our communities.
Mm-hmm.
So that we suddenly find exposed the inner splits of all that we believe to be true and good in the world that don't work out the way we're told they should have.
Mm-hmm.
The ways that We find we've betrayed ourselves and one another by buying into those dreams, those particular narratives that may not in the long run be the healthy narratives for ourselves, for our planet, for one another, for our communities, for our children.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the things we're seeing on the ecological front. The whole field of eco-psychology is a relatively new and burgeoning notion of how we understand our relationship to the environment, how that relationship has nurtured us in the past, and how unavailable in some ways it has become in the Western world because of the particular relationship we've developed with nature.
Yeah.
And how that's now beginning mm-hmm. to affect our sense of our own values and our relationship, and to change that, I hope, in some very positive ways.
Yes, that's the hope. And I think the other piece that I see, and we're coming to kind of the end of the show,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, it's interesting because I've been in the communications field. And so that involves, you know, communicating with the public or communicating with a specialized audience or, you know, reaching this one or that one through blogs or this radio program and other things. But there's also a lot of, you know, kind of group communication. And listening and hearing that are needed within work groups, within activist organizations, within communities, and, you know, there a basic kind of language of skills and listening
mm-hmm.
that I think would, I mean, as you're describing it, I think it really, without it, you breed, you know, or the groups, any group effort to do something constructive will fall by the wayside. By virtue of the bad the kind of unfortunate communication patterns that we've all learned and pick up and
mm-hmm.
how we share and express and process things together. But that could be better optimized, and as you describe it, that can actually be a way of healing trauma and improving immunity to social trauma.
Yeah.
In smaller group settings. So I'm very heartened because I personally have felt drawn to that.
Mm-hmm.
As kind of a new bud on the communications branch of the tree, sort of
sure.
thing. We are coming to the end of our show, and, you know, as I had suspected before when we first talked about having you here on the air, Fred, one program will not be enough, so I want to, you know, thank you for joining me. I want to thank our listeners for participating and being present for this deep conversation, and also let people know that we will be continuing it on Connect the Dots. And I invite people to write to me at my Health Journalist blog website or on Facebook with any questions or other areas of exploration that you would like to hear Dr. Fred Irwin and me discuss.
And I will look forward to that.
Yeah, I think it'll be great. Thank you so much, Fred.
Thank you, Allison.
And thank you, listeners. Stay tuned next week for our next edition of Connect the Dots every Wednesday at 10 on Progressive Radio. Thanks for listening. I'm Allison Lozzini.